Thanks, Jim. This is fun. Joe Grenfest is fun, and I'm sure we're in for a very interesting and enjoyable presentation. Just a couple words about Joe. Since 1990, he's been at Stanford Law School, where he is the Franke Professor of Law and Business, also the Crocker Faculty Scholar. Before that, he served for over 4 years as a commissioner at the SEC. He's practiced in private practice. He served as counsel for the President's Council of Economic Advisors at one point. In addition to completing his legal training, he also has done extensive graduate work in economics. I've noticed that noted legal scholars these days tend to have done extensive graduate work in economics. He's a widely published and respected scholar of the securities laws. And he's also been recognized several times at Stanford as a superb teacher. He's a delightful guy and a good friend. Joe, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you very much. Just a couple of preliminary observations. First, it is absolutely wonderful to see all of you here this evening. We are competing with the President's State of the Union address, and it's rather remarkable that so many of you are here and not glued to your television sets at home. And I started thinking, what could possibly explain the turnout? And then I realized, they don't serve dinner at the State of Union, all right? We've got dinner going over here, so I'm sure that many of you have come at least for the food. The other thing that's really wonderful is I look out at this audience, how many former students and colleagues and friends I see here. I'd like to say hello personally to every single one of you, so this is my personal hello. Hi, how are you? And also before I start, I'd like to draw particular attention to one person in the audience, Susan Jenny Eyre. Susan, where are you? Susan's hiding all the way in back. There's a tremendous amount of empirical work that's gone into the presentation I'll be sharing with you this evening. And let me just say at the outset, none of this would have been possible without Susan's diligence and extraordinary attention to detail. And I think you'll see exactly what I mean during the course of this presentation. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to be roaming around, so I hope I don't do anything terrible to the audio in terms of this presentation. But the topic of the presentation is the theory and practice of statutory interpretation, suggestion being that there's a real difference between the words that get mumbled in some decisions, the theory that people think should apply, and the practice, the reality of what it is that courts sometimes do. What we're going to be doing is we're going to be looking at the evidence with respect to the theory and practice by looking at one of the favorite statutory provisions here in Silicon Valley, the strong inference provision of the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995. And as you'll see, once we get into the data, another fair description of the presentation is CIBIL, statutes with multiple personality disorders. Because, as we will see, the statute that we're interpreting in this case is subject to multiple different interpretations, all of them, in a sense, potentially quite reasonable. Let me try to telegraph the overview, an overview of the presentation. If you have a look at this slide, the strong inference equilibrium, a summary of the analysis, here's really what's going on, as far as we can figure it out in this case. The courts generate rules of statutory construction. Guess what? These rules of statutory construction are not a state secret. Congress knows all about these rules. Congress generates the statutory text and the legislative history negotiating in the shadow of the rules of interpretation. When it's difficult to pass legislation, and the 1995 Reform Act had to get passed over the president's veto, you can in effect have, as the First Circuit said in FTP, an agreement to disagree over the meaning of the statute. There are many different forms that an agreement to disagree can take. One of them is to pass statutory language that's gibberish, you have no idea what it means. Another approach is to pass statutory language that can support multiple competing, conflicting interpretations. And we'll have a look at the data here, suggesting that that is what happened. The strong inference language has multiple conflicting interpretations under the prevailing rules of construction. And this is not an accident. It's the only way the statute could, in fact, come into being. That gives rise to a prediction. If this analysis in those top three boxes is correct, we can, as an empirical matter, predict that the strong inference language should generate judicial opinions that actually support multiple conflicting interpretations. All right, that the courts should disagree, all right, and should split along fairly predictable lines in terms of the frequency of the splits with respect to the interpretation of language, and we'll see the data support that theory. Prediction holds true, certainly at the appellate level, and we'll have a look at all six appellate decisions, and early analysis at the district court level also appears to be consistent with this prediction. And in addition, we're going to engage in some empirical analysis of what we call constrained legal realism hypotheses, and we'll find that although we don't have data on what judges had for breakfast on particular mornings, it turns out that other patterns of judicial behavior are apparently apparent in the data. Brief outline of the presentation. We'll go through the question presented. There'll be a little bit of cautionary language about the analysis, which is still very much in progress. We'll do a very brief overview of the statutory language and a little bit of the legislative history. I'm not going to talk very much at all about the rules of statutory interpretation and construction. I'll assume that everybody here at the dinner knows enough about them for purposes of this presentation. We'll go through very briefly the plaintiffs' and the defendants' interpretations of what the strong inference language means. We'll then present an alternative perspective that plaintiffs and defendants don't argue for the rational reason, even if it might be true, there's no percentage in it for the defendants or the plaintiffs to argue that, gee, there are multiple competing reasonable interpretations of the statute. That's not what you want the court to say. You want the court to adopt your favorite version, all right? You want the court to decide that, no, your version is the dominant personality in Civil, all right? And that's how we're going to interpret the statute. So how, in fact, do courts decide? We'll present seven hypotheses that might describe some of the court behavior at the district court level. We'll go through the circuit court data, where we've done a preliminary analysis. We have the entire universe. Fascinating results. And we'll do some preliminary analysis of the district court data, where, again, much more work remains to be done. But even on a preliminary basis, we're kind of surprised about the very interesting patterns we're discovering in judicial decision making. Question presented. How do... In other words, we're just interested in a description of fact, a positive description of reality. We're not interested in the normative theoretical question of should. The question is do, not should. How do, not should, judges interpret a statute that can support multiple inconsistent interpretations of the text and multiple inconsistent interpretations of the legislative history? Before diving into this question, I'd like to present all of us with some very important cautionary language. This cautionary language will be funny only to securities lawyers. If you are not a securities lawyer and you find yourself chuckling at this, please come see me. Some professional counseling might be in order. Except for the historical information contained herein, the matters set forth in this presentation are forward-looking statements within the meaning of the safe harbor provisions of the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995. These forward-looking statements are subject to risks and uncertainties that may cause actual results to differ materially from those reported herein. And this is actually true. We're still doing the analysis. As a result of further data verification, all right, we're double-checking all the data, acquisition of new data, we're coding new cases, analysis of additional variables, we haven't done all the variable analysis yet, statistical analyses that have not yet been conducted, particularly multivariate analysis. What you'll see is we just have crosstabs, we just have tables. There are all of these fancy logit regressions and the like that we're going to run, but we haven't run those yet. And then, most importantly, mature reflection. Okay? We may sit down at some point and think about what we're saying and change what it is that we're saying. So please, let me caution you that mature reflection still has to occur over here, and the results may be modified in light of that. All right, so what is the subject? What is the cause of all of this mayhem? Statutory language. All right, and remember, statutory construction, if you can find the plain meaning in the text, all right, the interpretation ends right there. You never have to go to the legislative history. The complaint shall, with respect to each act or omission alleged to violate this chapter, state with particularity facts giving rise to a strong inference that the defendant acted with the requisite state of mind. Okay, now just like beauty is in the eye of the beholder, all right, textual clarity can also be in the eye of the beholder, and this strong inference provision exists separate and apart from the 9B requirement that fraud always be pled with particularity. A little bit of background. The Second Circuit, prior to the adoption of this statute, had a string of cases that imposed a strong inference requirement, and a large part of the debate is whether the statutory language that we had just looked at intended to adopt the Second Circuit standard, calling for an application of Second Circuit law as to what the strong inference requirement called for, or whether there was some other standard different from the Second Circuit's that would dominate the interpretation of the statutory language. All right, if you wind up finding a need to go to the legislative history, and this is a partial sampling, all right, I'm sure that another person going through the legislative history would give you a different sampling of the legislative history, and I make no assertion that this is complete or balanced or fair or accurate. It's interesting, all right, not any of the others. In the article that we write, we will put everything in, and nobody will read it. Senate report. The committee chose a uniform standard modeled upon the pleading standards of the Second Circuit, which requires that the plaintiff plead facts that give rise to a strong inference. The committee does not intend to codify the Second Circuit's case law interpreting this pleading standard, although the courts may find this body of law instructive. I trust that that is instructive, all right? Now, if that isn't clear, I don't know what is clear. Statement of the managers. Because the conference committee intends to strengthen existing pleading requirements, it does not intend to codify the Second Circuit's case law interpreting this pleading standard. All right, that appears to go in a particular direction, saying we're looking for something stronger than whatever the Second Circuit said strong inference meant. But then the president vetoes the bill that's presented to him, and in the president's veto message, he says, I'm prepared to support the high pleading standard of the Second Circuit, the highest pleading standard of any federal circuit. But the conferees make crystal clear their intent to raise the standard even beyond that level. I am not prepared to accept that. So if the president's interpretation of the language of the statute and the legislative history means anything, the president thinks that strong inference means more than what the Second Circuit says strong inference means. Have I lost anybody yet? Have I lost everybody yet? Then the Senate override statements. In floor debates responding to the president's veto, Senator Dodd, a manager of the legislation, rejected the president's interpretation. You're only the president. What the hell do you know about the legislation that we're trying to pass? You vetoed it for the wrong reason. You misread, all right? The statute meets the Second Circuit standard. We left out the guidance. That does not mean you disregard it. Senator Domenici, even more to the point, explained that the statute was a codification of the Second Circuit rule. All right? So after making those statements, you then get an override of the president's veto, which was based on the premise that the Second Circuit standard was not what was being adopted under those circumstances. All right? So there you go. You now have that language in a statute. You have that history spilled all over the congressional record, and plaintiffs are going to argue that it's clear that this statute and this history means a particular thing, the Second Circuit standard. Defendants are going to come in and argue with just as much passion that it's perfectly clear that this statute means only one thing, and it means much more than the Second Circuit standard. Among the plaintiffs' interpretations are the arguments that the text is clear. All right. Only the Second Circuit had used the strong inference formulation prior to the statute. Therefore, the Second Circuit standard is the natural meaning of the text, and resort to the legislative history is absolutely unnecessary. All right. That's the only cognate in this area of law. QED, end of story. Even if you're so benighted that you have to go to the legislative history, what do you find? Senator Dodd and Senator Domenici's statements in support of the Second Circuit view, telling the president he has no idea what he's vetoing, and no rejection of the Second Circuit view by the Senator of the Conference Committee. All right, it's instructive, you know, maybe you want to do, but you're not rejecting it anywhere. Meanwhile, defendants in their briefs wind up making arguments with the following flavors. Strong inference has a plain dictionary meaning, and that plain dictionary meaning exists separate and apart from the Second Circuit standard. For example, a reasonable inference of whatever the state of mind is insufficient. It has to be a strong inference. You don't have to go to the Second Circuit to find plain meaning for these words. There are at least two ways to go at it. Under those circumstances, and by the way, there were at least three different strands of the strong inference decisions of the Second Circuit, so you can't say that there's any direct plain meaning from the use of the phrase strong inference. Which Second Circuit version of strong inference are we looking at? You can't tell from the text of the statute. Also, the statute does not refer to the Second Circuit when it clearly could have done so. And if you go to the legislative history, which is necessary if you can't find clarity in the text, what do you see? A refusal to codify the Second Circuit standard an intent to strengthen the existing pleading requirements, and the override of a presidential veto that clearly objected to a stronger than Second Circuit interpretation. What could be more clear than Congress intended either to adopt the Second Circuit interpretation or to adopt something stronger than the Second Circuit interpretation? Now, game theorists will explain that this is, there's an alternative perspective, which is not argued, as I suggested, by either plaintiffs or defendants, because it's not in their client's best interest to argue this alternative. This is why law professors exist. Because we don't have clients in this, and we can take a different sort of look and try to analyze the data from an entirely different perspective. Congress, in fact, we think, agreed to disagree about the strong inference standard. And instead, there are, in reality, multiple and inconsistent plain meanings of the text. It's not that any one plain meaning is right and all the others are wrong. They're all there. And there are multiple and inconsistent interpretations of the legislative history. It's not that one interpretation is clearly correct and the others are clearly foolish. They all make just about the same amount of sense. Now, why should that exist? All right? Because a text with a single plain meaning and a legislative history with a clear intent could not muster sufficient votes to become law. If you are going to pass this bill and override the presidential veto, members of Congress had to be able to argue that the statute meant what they thought it meant or what they wanted to argue to their constituents that it meant, and there was no consensus on what it actually meant. In other words, you had to find language sufficiently robust to support diametrically opposed interpretations of that language. The result is a statute with what I'm calling a multiple personality disorder, and the judiciary is in a position of having to pick the dominant personality of all of the personalities you can find in that statute. Remember the book or the movie Sybil? Remember the movie The Three Faces of Eve? We have the statutory equivalent of those situations on our hands. Now, game theorists will tell you that this is not really a very rare situation. You could actually should expect this kind of behavior to happen, because bargaining in the shadow of law would predict that Congress will, under these circumstances, occasionally adopt statutes either without clear meaning, total gibberish, or with multiple conflicting meanings. We're not going to get into Nash equilibria, but as a technical matter, these things are Nash equilibria to the legislative bargaining process, and the result is that the courts are, in effect, delegated a legislative function within a zone of reasonableness. Congress says, we can't decide within this zone, and we're going to punt over to you, the judiciary, and we're going to leave it up to you guys to decide. And only if Congress can later decide that the decisions reached by the judiciary are sufficiently inconsistent with the will and the desire of a later sitting Congress do you, in effect, get a legislative override by Congress passing some language that clarifies what it says it meant, even though it didn't really mean that at the time. But in effect, it's telling the courts, come back, we now mean something different, or we've decided what it is that we want to mean. I'll skip the next page with the math. Okay. And we'll go to the next question. The math is interesting to many people, and none of them are at dinner with us this evening. I know both of them, and they're not here. How would we, and by we, I mean my co-author, Adam Pritchard, and I, decide the issue if the issue were actually presented to us? Now, this is clearly not the subject of the research, all right? This is asking the normative question, what would you do, all right? This normative question is relevant, we think, in part because it reveals our views, helps readers adjust for any interpretive biases that we might impose on the data. All right, if we're going to be categorizing the data, looking at it in a variety of ways, if we have a bias, we think our readers should know about the bias. Now, if forced to decide based on text and history alone, which you'll see we'd like to avoid doing because there really is no there, I would concur with the Ninth Circuit Silicon Graphics standard. I would do it pretty much for the reasons stated therein. I would also emphasize the mischief that arises under the Second Circuit's view, all right, under press, which is the motive and opportunity standard, and I'll explain that in a moment. It's really rather remarkable if you look carefully what the Second Circuit did. My colleague, Adam Pritchard, would support the SEC's interpretation, which he calls the Second Circuit standard, but with bite. I always joke, you know, my gosh, if you've got this toothless thing, how's the bite going to hurt? You don't understand. You're just mashing gums together. I don't get it. And for the reasons articulated in the SEC's brief. And I should mention that Adam Pritchard wrote the SEC's briefs, all right, in these cases. And as you'll see, all right, in all of the, I'll just telegraph ahead. You know, there's the doctrine of deference to expert agencies. In all of the judicial opinions at the district court level and at the circuit court level, no circuit court has followed the SEC's interpretation of the statute. We've got 170 some odd district court decisions. Exactly one district court has followed the SEC's view. And, you know, when we were doing the coding, you know, Adam said, gee, maybe what we should do is we just drop out the SEC code. It's not going to be statistically significant. I said, you got to be a good empiricist. We've proven a very important point. And Adam says, what's that? He says, nobody believes the SEC when it comes to matters of statutory construction in this space. So you can either believe that the SEC's expertise does not extend to these matters of statutory interpretation, or that the agency maybe has burned out its welcome, which is another theory on some of these issues. Adam and I, however, would prefer not to rely on traditional interpretive techniques. Why? Because they're designed to fail. All right, Congress crafted, all right, the legislation and the history so as not to allow those techniques to really give you any confidence that you can interpret the statute with any meaning. Instead, we take a very different approach. It's what Posner would call a wealth-maximizing, efficiency-enhancing approach. And what we do is we presume that Congress, if it knew how to, would prefer the approach that minimizes the cost imposed by litigation and maximizing the deterrence against the fraud. You want to maximize the benefits of the legislation. You want to minimize the cost of the legislation. But that's an empirical matter. So our preferred interpretation relies on an empirical question that can't be resolved by reference to the text or to the legislative history. The interpretation must come from elsewhere. And it turns out that there is recent research that Adam and some of his colleagues here at Stanford and Michigan have done. It's a paper that's available on the internet, and you've all got copies of it there, which is really rather remarkable. It does an event analysis, and it examines how the stock prices of high-tech companies reacted to the announcement of the Ninth Circuit's decision in Silicon Graphics. And what it finds is that that decision produced positive abnormal stock returns for a large sample of high technology companies, particularly those headquartered in the Ninth Circuit. I have some additional data that I'd like to share with you here. We didn't put this in the chart because the numbers are meaningful. Sample of 311 high-tech firms, 277 of those firms survived in the sample. The others were dropped out because they'd already been sued, so they figured it was unfair to look at the stock price effect there. 93 of those firms within the Ninth Circuit, the rest were all outside. Of the companies in the Ninth Circuit, their stock price increased by an average of 2.8%. upon the announcement of the Silicon Graphics decision, and the companies outside the Ninth Circuit had their stock prices increased by 1.27% as a result of that decision, suggesting that net-net society was better off as a result of the Ninth Circuit's decision. In addition, they did a very complicated analysis, which might be controversial, trying to segment their sample into companies more likely to be sued for meritorious complaints of securities fraud and companies less likely to be so sued. And there what they found is that the stock price effect was consistent with the idea that the Ninth Circuit's decision is wealth maximizing. Because the data further suggested firms the minimal risk of a lawsuit due to fraudulent activity stand to benefit most from the Ninth Circuit's decision, while those with the highest risk of being sued for committing fraud will benefit the least, if at all. In other words, they have a metric that they've designed, and we can debate it, as to whether a company is more likely to engage in fraud in the future, all right, and to be sued with a meritorious lawsuit. And they find that those companies' stock prices did not move up very much, if at all, but it's companies that are likely to be hit with lawsuits that are more likely to be viewed as frivolous that saw their stock prices increase the most, okay? Which is a subset of the analysis and very interesting if you believe their categorization. Now, very important caveat. We recognize that this approach could not be applied as a practical matter prior to the Silicon Graphics decision, all right? If you're a judge and you have to decide Silicon Graphics, these data aren't available to you. All right, it's wrong and it's unfair to say, well, gee, this is what the courts should have done. All right, the only way you know the consequences of the decision is to make the decision. Then after the fact, academics can go back and look at the stock market's price response to the judicial decision. But this mode of analysis, which is the one that I prefer, simply wouldn't be available to any judge. And if I were a judge forced to sit in judgment on this issue, I wouldn't be able to resort to this bag of tricks. In order to come up with my proposed solution. So there is a sense in which it's very important to recognize that this mode of suggested interpretation is not, as a practical matter, available to sitting judges. What we've done is we've looked at all six courts of appeal that have interpreted the strong inference standard, and the patterns in the data suggest that Congress was very successful, thank you, in adopting a statute and creating one with a multiple personality disorder. And also, very interesting, if you just look at the Court of Appeals data and the district court data are coming in somewhat differently, the precise locution of the standard may not be a powerful predictor of the result. In other words, the outcome may not depend so much at the Court of Appeals level on whether you adopt the Second Circuit standard, some intermediate standard like the SEC has been proposing, or the strictest standard which the Ninth Circuit has been articulating. Or put another way, the standard may not determine outcomes as forcefully as some observers predict. The next chart is a detailed description of those six decisions. Well, actually, let me skip ahead. Let me give you the lay of the land, and then we'll go into the details. You can rank the courts, the six courts that have looked at the decision, along the following spectrum, going from stringent, from less stringent to more stringent. Less stringent on the left, more stringent on the right. The less stringent interpretations, in other words, the most pro-plaintiff interpretations, are adopted by the Second Circuit and the Third Circuit. The primary factor that determines whether an interpretation is more or less stringent is whether the interpretation allows something called the motive and opportunity standard. In other words, to demonstrate strong inference, is it sufficient to plead that the defendant had a motive to engage in the fraud and the defendant had the opportunity to conduct the behavior that gives rise to the fraud? The Second Circuit standard has a second part, which is described as follows. Or you can plead strong circumstantial evidence of conscious misbehavior or recklessness. That second prong of the Second Circuit standard is really very similar to the deliberate or conscious reckless behavior required by the Ninth Circuit in Silicon Graphics. So it's probably not too far from the truth or entirely accurate to say that the Ninth Circuit standard is pretty close to the second half of the Second Circuit standard. And the distinguishing characteristic is that the Second Circuit will accept mere motive and opportunity. The Ninth Circuit will reject it. All right, so if you want a description of how you get this layout, that's how it arises. So the Second Circuit will accept motive and opportunity. The Third Circuit says we're pretty close to the Second Circuit. In fact, geographically, they are pretty close to the Second Circuit. The Ninth Circuit is all the way out here in California. So they're very, very far from New York, you know, and New Jersey. So all of this fits with all sorts of patterns we find in the data. And the 6th, 11th, and 1st circuits, okay, are all sort of clustered in the middle. And if you read the 1st circuit, you can't tell where they are. The 6th, I think, is slightly closer to the 2nd and 3rd. But, you know, I would agree with any different ordering within this cluster. So what you really have is three clusters in the data. You've got motive and opportunity suffices. Really good motive and really good opportunity suffices. Don't talk to me about motive and opportunity, all right? I want to see some strong inference of conscious, reckless disregard or conscious wrongdoing, all right? Ninth Circuit, okay? So that's how the courts have split, and recognize that if you, as Congress intended to adopt a statute that could be interpreted at least three different ways, you have succeeded, all right? The courts of appeal have taken at least three different interpretations of that statute. Now, if we drill down in greater detail and look at what the courts have done in this space, there's some very interesting patterns that arise in the data. The Second Circuit decision in Press, obviously motive and opportunity suffices. The Sixth Circuit and the Ninth, 11th, all right, actually, you know, the Third and the Sixth, I'm sorry, the Sixth and the 11th, in effect, say no, motive and opportunity don't suffice, but a bit more than that will actually get you there. The Ninth Circuit, as I've suggested, requires deliberate or consciously reckless behavior. The First flips on that. But going back up to the Second Circuit's interpretation of motive and opportunity in press. If you read the decision carefully, what you discover is the result was it affirmed the dismissal of the complaint, but not on these pleading grounds. Instead, the court ruled that motive and opportunity was adequately pled. The strong inference requirement was met, just barely, but it was met. But the complaint was dismissed because the alleged misrepresentation was, believe it or not, immaterial. Help me out. A misstatement of an immaterial fact is sufficient to satisfy a strong inference requirement? All right? Why would anybody at any level of scienter, all right, make a misrepresentation of an immaterial fact? And the idea that a court could find a strong inference of a state of mind embracing an intent to deceive about a fact that nobody would rationally care about makes very little sense to me. Okay? So there's a sense in which the Second Circuit adopting its own standard in press and then dismissing the complaint because of the lack of materiality proves the danger of going with the motive and opportunity standard. And in fact, sort of underscores the reason why I always thought that there was too much mischief there, and I just, you know, couldn't believe the good fortune of my view saying, you know, my God, the Second Circuit in press actually writes it down and says you can find that even on immaterial facts. Very interesting pattern in the data, though. Look at the outcome characterization. In each one of these cases, it's a result that if you had to categorize it as either pro-plaintiff or pro-defendant, it's a pro-defendant result, all right? Either a motion to dismiss is upheld, either summary judgment is upheld, or the denial is remanded, go back and reconsider it. There was reason for the defendant to celebrate in each of these six cases and for the plaintiff to be disappointed. That suggests, in part, that no matter what the standard, there's sufficient plasticity in the application of the standard and in the interpretation of the underlying facts to be able to reach conclusions that are at least uniformly in favor of the defendant. Further, with the recent decision not to go for cert in Silicon Graphics, which many people thought would be the best case for the plaintiffs to take to the Supreme Court because it was the most anti-plaintiff interpretation, the time for applying for cert, for petitioning for cert has passed, we now have a situation where after six opportunities to take a clear split among the circuits up to the Supreme Court, no plaintiff has yet filed, all right, a petition for cert. Why? What strong inference do you draw from that form of behavior? Anybody want to take a stab? Yes, sir.
Well, there's always a danger of disimplying private right of action. I think you know a lot about that.
So what I'm sorry.
That's a possibility, unlikely given that Congress has virtually ratified private right of action in various statutes. But there's a real danger of a really tough decision that is not as malleable as these decisions might be.
I think that's exactly right. I think Ignacio's analysis is correct. I think the plaintiffs are looking at the composition of the Supreme Court. They're counting noses. And what they're saying is, oh boy, if we raise this issue, there are two issues that are going to come up before the Supreme Court, at least two. One is, what does the word scienter mean? All right. And the Supreme Court has twice reserved the question of whether scienter encompasses recklessness. And plaintiffs are doing very well at the Court of Appeals level because every Court of Appeal that's addressed the issue has said that recklessness suffices for scienter. However, if you're going to take the issue of strong inference of the underlying state of mind, and if you're going to appeal that up to the Supreme Court almost can't avoid the question of what's the underlying state of mind as to which the strong inference must be pled. So the risk for the plaintiffs is you could lose the recklessness standard, and then you could also lose the strong inference standard. Would you prefer the status quo, where you can operate at the Court of Appeals level, all right, and be able to say recklessness always suffices, and you know you'll do better in New York than in California? Would you rather have that difficult situation, or the potentially much more difficult situation of losing the recklessness standard nationwide and then getting a Ninth Circuit interpretation of what you have to plead to? I think that's the reason why the plaintiffs are concerned, and don't want to take this up to the Supreme Court. And if we ever get a Supreme Court decision in this area, it will happen after a defendant takes a loss in one of these cases and decides to try to take that case up before the Supremes. Now, when you start analyzing the data at the district court level, we have many, many more data points. As you'll see, we have more than 170. And what we've done is we've generated 7 distinct hypotheses, all right? And all of them are forms of tests of the constrained legal realism hypothesis. I'll just describe them, then I'll go into each one in more detail. One, does the statute really have a multiple personality disorder as interpreted at the district court level? Two, the words don't matter much. You can achieve whatever result you want without regard to the interpretation. Three, familiarity breeds contempt. All right, I know what goes on in these cases. Go away. Fourth, the docket control case. I'm very busy. Go away case. You bother me. Fifth, high tech is different. All right, high tech cases get decided differently. Judicial politics, very interesting. I personally didn't expect to find any traction in the data if you divided it by which president nominated which judge. I was wrong. That's the great thing about being an empiricist. The data can surprise you. That's why you do empirical work. Otherwise, you already know everything. And then clustering and precedent, or at least you can fool yourself into thinking you already know everything. And then clustering and precedent, to what extent do we find persuasive decisions at the district court level? All right, very briefly, hypothesis one. All right, and the great thing about the empirical approach is you actually write down the hypotheses before you go and look at the data so you know what you're looking for, and the hypothesis is either verified or falsified. And that way you learn something from going out and rolling up your sleeves and testing stuff in the real world. The hypothesis you've already seen, Congress successfully adopted a statute, legislative history can support multiple inconsistent interpretations. Prediction, no one interpretation of the language will be dominant. All right, the interpretation at the district court level will be all over the place. Observation, pattern is consistent with this. At the appellate level, district court still to be analyzed, but the early data that you'll see is consistent with this interpretation. Hypothesis two, the words don't matter very much. There's sufficient plasticity in the facts that are interpreted by the court and in the interpretations of the standard, that even if you fix on any one of the three dominant interpretations, you can still reach whatever conclusion you want as a judge. Prediction, no strong correlations between the outcome and the statutory interpretation. Observation, the patterns of the Court of Appeals decision, plaintiffs always lose, notwithstanding the outcome. It's loosely consistent with this hypothesis. We'll see this hypothesis is not borne out at the district court level the way it is so far at the Court of Appeals level, but it's still nonetheless fascinating to observe that courts of appeal are acting as a practical matter as though the standard is not outcome determinative. Familiarity breeds contempt. The more frequently a court deals with securities fraud class actions, the more skeptical it becomes of the merits of these actions. The opposite side of the coin is that a judge who rarely sees securities fraud cases will be less prone to dismiss. All right. What's the statistical articulation of that hypothesis? You make a prediction that after controlling for other variables, courts with a higher frequency or intensity of securities fraud class actions will adopt higher pleading standards or dismiss cases more frequently. All right. After doing the statistical methods of multiple regression and controlling. All right. So you can actually test whether that hypothesis is true. Hypothesis four, the docket control hypothesis. Judges are very busy, and they could rationally adopt interpretations that are designed to make life easier for them. So judges with more active dockets will adopt strategies to reduce the amount of court time needed to dispose of these matters. There are two strategies available to judges that want to behave this particular way. First, courts could adopt higher pleading standards to make it easier to dismiss cases early out. Or judges know that as a practical matter, these cases always settle. And what the judge can say is, look, I'm going to take the easy way out. I'm going to refuse to dismiss this case because that way I don't even have to take the effort of writing a decision that dismisses it. You guys, go settle the case. Come back to me when you have a settlement. All right? Now, these two interpretations would cause the coefficient on the variable in a regression to go either direction. So our prediction basically is if the docket control hypothesis is correct, a statistically significant coefficient on a docket load variable, whether that coefficient is positive or negative, would wind up supporting this theory. A priori, we're not expecting to find much traction in this variable because they're two different strategies. So even if it exists, you can have counteracting behavior by the judges as they're attempting to achieve the same result. So little statistical problem over there. We don't think that we're going to be able to resolve it. Hypothesis 5, the high-tech hypothesis, it's basically the same as prediction 3. The more high-tech cases you see, the less you like this category of litigation. There, the theory being less merit to the high-tech cases than to any other species of these cases. Hypothesis 6, interesting, the judicial politics hypothesis. Judges who are nominated by Republican slash Democratic presidents are, by this hypothesis, less or more friendly to class action litigation, and would therefore tend to dismiss cases more or less often and or adopt stronger or weaker interpretations of pleading standards, all right? So what you do is you categorize the judge by the president that nominated the judge, and then you cluster into Democrat and Republican, all right, and you see whether in certain crosstabs or regressions, that regression actually has some traction. All right, prediction before looking at the data. After controlling for other factors, judges appointed by Republican presidents would tend to adopt more stringent interpretations and or dismiss cases more frequently. All right, for Democrats, it goes in exactly the opposite direction. Okay. Last hypothesis, that district court judges may be persuaded by a particularly well-reasoned decision issued by a well-respected judge. So again, we can make a prediction. And that is, we should observe runs in the data, a series of decisions that agree with each other prior to the issuance of controlling appellate decisions, because once you've got a controlling appellate decision, game over, all right? You're not following a persuasive opinion of a fellow judge. You're doing what you have to do in terms of applying the law of the circuit. Not as interesting. But after the issuance of decisions that are frequently decided. So in other words, there should be a decision. The decision is influential. You can determine that it's influential because it's frequently followed, frequently cited in subsequent cases, and the interpretation is frequently followed. So put differently, we should observe what statisticians will call serial correlation in the interpretive standards at the district court level prior to the issuance of a decision by the Court of Appeals governing that district. All right, so now the hypotheses are out there, and I will briefly try to share with you a summary of the data that we're in the process of analyzing. And again, I can't thank Susan Eyre enough, and also Jeff Wu, my other research assistant, who's been working on this, because the attention to detail and the amount of work that goes into this is rather mind-boggling. What we have here is an analysis of 192 decisions in 174 cases. Often one case will generate more than one decision because you get a motion to dismiss and then it gets replayed and you get another decision in that case. We have decisions from 42 district courts. We've categorized the pleading standards in many but not all of the cases. The outcomes are categorized in many but not all. We've looked at the nominating president, and additional work is going on in those variables. There are additional variables that we have not even looked at to this point. So what do we find when we look at the initial variable, which is the distribution of the pleading standards? Okay. We find what Congress hoped we'd find, which is a distribution and no one real consensus. Let me explain what these categories mean. They're ranged basically from most pro-plaintiff down to most pro-defendant. Some judges, avoid the need to reach a decision as to the interpretation of the strong inference standard because they say, look, I've read this complaint, and I don't care where you set the bar on strong inference, this complaint passes the bar. This is one gosh darn good complaint, all right? And that, as you can imagine, is probably the most pro-plaintiff interpretation of a complaint that you'll ever run across. Now, it in fact may be such a good complaint, and the behavior may be so bad, that it's a perfectly legitimate interpretation. There's no suggestion one way or another with respect to that aspect of the interpretation. The Second Circuit interpretation is more pro-plaintiff than the SEC. There's an intermediate standard that's called the Baeza standard. There's the SGI standard, which is the most pro-defendant. And then there are a group of judges that avoid the need to reach an interpretation because they're saying, look, I don't care what strong inference means. You don't even pass the old Rule 9B on this complaint. Even if Congress never passed the 95 Act, I would throw this puppy right out of here. Okay? You fail the lowest standard, all right? And typically that gets articulated as a 9B standard. And then these are cases where the specific categorization is hard to do. All right, so we're going to have more eyeballs look at the case, and there are all sorts of statistical techniques to make sure the final result isn't biased by different forms of categorization here. So these 53 cases, which is a pretty significant number, are going to require much more attention, and that's what we're doing in the process of slotting these cases into different bins. You know, a couple of quick observations. If you take the BAESA and the SGI standard, both of which clearly reject the simple mode of an opportunity test, you have just about as many courts, district courts, rejecting simple mode of an opportunity as you have accepting simple mode of an opportunity. They do it in a variety of different ways, all right, but it's pretty much split 50-50 in terms of who's accepted the Second Circuit approach and who said, no, we're going to reject the prior Second Circuit law and we need something more. There's then a 50-50 split as to how much more you need, all right? Do you need a very strong inference of that mode of an opportunity, but not mere mode of an opportunity, or do you need to go to the conscious disregard standard that the Ninth Circuit requires? So the data at this point, early data, are suggestive of the fact that the multiple personality disorder hypothesis is true at the district court level as well as at the court of appeals level. Now, here is some really neat stuff. Or at least I think it's really neat. A breakdown of the pleading standard adopted by the individual courts. All right, and again, in order to get you the lay of the land, what we've done is we've listed the courts that have the most frequent decisions. The Southern District of New York is now the highest volume jurisdiction. Prior to the 95 Act, it used to be the Northern District of California. All right, it's now the Southern District of New York. 33 decisions out of SD New York, 22 out of Northern District of California. So for purposes of statistical analysis, think of it as a ratio of 3-2. All right, if there is no difference in the patterns of behavior between the Southern District of New York and the Northern District of California, you should see all the data across the rows spread in a ratio of 3-2. They're not.
Hold on. Let me do this one, excuse me. This is in the wrong sequence. This is the finer gradation. Okay. We're still gathering the data on the civil docket and docket per judge. That'll be for the docket control hypothesis. That's why that column is blank. Now, we then rank the pleading standard, again, from the most pro-plaintiff result in terms of interpretation of the pleading standard to the most pro-defendant result, which is the avoid low. And then we have other, there's the distribution of the cases that still have to be categorized. A couple of things are rather remarkable over here. Look at the avoid high. Look at those five cases in the Southern District of New York, okay? The Northern District of California doesn't have a single judge that's avoided a result by saying, oh, I'm not going to interpret this case because it meets even the highest interpretation. Same in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania, same in the District of Massachusetts, same in the Northern District of Illinois. You've got to get down to Central District of California, and they only did it once. So although there's more data analysis to be done, the early analysis suggests that this pattern of avoiding a decision by saying it meets the highest standard is located in the Southern District of New York with a statistical frequency that is not random. In other words, it's a style of judging at Foley Square that doesn't exist anywhere else in the nation. Okay? Now, there's a style of judging that may be here in San Francisco that also appears not to exist as frequently in the rest of the nation, although it certainly exists more than the first form. Look at the frequency of avoid low. Okay? The Southern District of New York only had 4 cases where they avoided a decision by saying you failed even the lowest standard on 9B. In the Northern District of California, there are 12 such cases. Okay, now, that may well be because the Northern District of California has a lot of high-tech cases, and if high-tech cases really are the worst cases, this can be perfectly legitimate. The other possibility is, and this is why we've got to do some more statistical work, that there really is a different style of interpretation of the statute that's actually going on in the Northern District of California. Some people may be curious to see that there are 5 SGI-style decisions in the Southern District of New York. In those five decisions, they tend to be earlier decisions, and these earlier decisions, in effect, go with the second half of the Second Circuit standard, which, as you recall, is very similar to the standard ultimately adopted by the Ninth Circuit. So it appears we do have, or at least we have the possibility, subject to further analysis of the data, of some really different styles at the district court level in interpreting exactly the same statutory language, and in particular, in avoiding interpretations of the statutory language. Purposes of time, I'll skip over page 30, which really is a review of the same data, just at a different level of coarseness. And we'll then move to 31, which looks at the question of the relationship between outcomes and interpretations. Okay? Here, if you look across the columns, it's the same set of columns that you just saw, ranked from the most pro-plaintiff on the left to the most pro-defendant on the right, to the avoid low, and then the other and the blank, you know, still remain to be categorized. And then the outcomes are categorized across the rows. Now, the outcome is ranked from most pro-plaintiff at the top, which is the result when a motion to dismiss is denied in full. That's the best thing that can happen to a plaintiff, down to the most pro-defendant, where the motion to dismiss is granted in full with prejudice as to all parts. You're out of here, babe. Okay? The defendant wants a result as close to the bottom of this chart as possible. The plaintiff wants a result as close to the top. All right? And then if you have a look at the intermediate categories, you'll be able to figure out why they're sequenced in that order. Okay? If the standard has meaning, then you should observe what mathematicians would call diagonalization in this matrix. In other words, the weaker pleading standards, which exist over towards the left, should cause more cases to cluster up towards the top, which is the result that the plaintiffs want. Okay? The stricter pleading standards, which are over to the right, should cause more cases to cluster down towards the bottom of the rows. If there is no meaning in terms of the application of the pleading standard to the final outcome, we should just see randomness. We should get a scatter plot, all right, throughout this chart. But if there is meaning of the sort that we would ascribe, you should see diagonalization. If it's real gibberish, the diagonal can go the other way, all right? People interpreting it, you know, which is the nice thing about doing the statistical analysis. You can be surprised by the data. Again, it's a very early interpretation, but it appears as though we're seeing the beginnings of diagonalization. Because at this level of granularity, here's a cluster of cases, more than 30 cases here, and here is a cluster of cases in the lower right. And you see a sprinkling throughout the rest of the matrix. So it appears that there is some correlation between the interpretation and the outcome. One can argue that the avoid high column is not interesting, all right? Because by definition, you're going to have a pro-plaintiff result because you're avoiding the result because you passed the highest level. So you would then look at diagonalization just in these two cells, or maybe these three cells. And the same result on the avoid low, you would then find much less diagonalization in this lower right-hand corner, which is a very interesting result. Because notice that even under the SGI standard, there are five cases in which the motion to dismiss was denied in full, all right? Roughly a quarter, all right? 20 to 25% of the cases that applied the SGI standard had the motion to dismiss denied in full. Three more of the case had the motion granted in part with no prejudice. So the early data appear to be loosely consistent with an interpretation that says, if the courts move to the Ninth Circuit's SGI standard, some of the cases are going to get thrown out, but just as many cases will survive. The motion to dismiss will be denied in full as will be thrown out. In other words, the SGI standard in practice appears to be operating as a pretty reasonable filter. In seven cases, the motion to dismiss is granted in full, but without prejudice. Go back, try to do a better job. And in terms of ultimate outcomes, the split is exactly 50-50. in terms of cases where motion to dismiss denied in full, go ahead, you got a great complaint, or with prejudice, you're out of here. The spread is not the same under the Second Circuit standard. Notice that there's much more weighting towards the top of that column than towards the bottom, suggesting that the probability of getting a case thrown out under the Second Circuit standard is not as high once that's adopted, suggesting that in practice, that standard is not operating as much of a filter as the Ninth Circuit standard is in fact operating. I will skip over the next chart, which is really the same data at a different level of granularity. And then, in light of the fact that this evening is the State of the Union message, it is quite intriguing and appropriate to present our last set of results, which is at page 33 of the chart talk, which is totally unexpected. This is something that we did not think, we had no reason to look for it. We just tabulated the data. We were sitting around in the office the other day, and we all looked at it, and our jaws dropped. All right? What do these data tell us? Look at the avoid high. All right? Well, first of all, look at the distribution of judges by nominating presidents. Okay? There are just as many decisions issued by judges nominated by President Clinton as there are by judges nominated by President Reagan. And it's roughly a ratio of 2 to 1 to 2 when you include President Bush. Okay? So, if you expected no correlation, all right, by nominating president, you would see a ratio of 2 to 1 to 2. Look at the avoid high. All right? There isn't a single Reagan appointee that has adopted the interpretation of saying, this complaint is so good, all right, that it passes even the highest standard, and virtually all of the traction in the avoid high area comes out of Clinton nominees, okay? And the Carter nominees don't even stack up in the same ratio, all right? So the avoid high phenomenon of saying this complaint is so good, all right, that it'll pass any standard appears to be driven by judges appointed by President Clinton, okay? The natural question to ask then is the SGI standard, all right, or the avoid low phenomenon driven by judges appointed by Republicans? And the answer there appears to be no, all right? If you have a look at the avoid low phenomenon, which is the opposite end of that spectrum, what you see is just about the same number of judges saying, hey, that's a lousy complaint. It doesn't pass 9B. We didn't need the 95 Reform Act to throw this case out. Just about the same number of Clinton appointees and Reagan appointees, and in a ratio of roughly 2 to 1 to 2. So there appears to be no political predisposition, all right, in terms of the decision to say this case is so bad, all right, that it doesn't pass 9B. However, there appears to be a political predisposition in terms of saying this complaint is so good, all right, it would pass even the highest standard. And you can phrase this one of two ways, either of saying that the Clinton appointees race to this result more than they should have, or the Reagan appointees avoid this result more than they should, all right? There's no way that we can tell from the data what the right interpretation of that is. The only thing that we can say is with respect to behavior in this upper left quadrant, all right, the judges are behaving differently, and they're breaking down along lines of the president who actually appointed them. That's all I have to say, all right? Based on the work that we've done to this point, that's as much as we found out about the real world nitty-gritty of what judges actually do when the traditional tools of statutory interpretation are of very, very little use at all. And I think here we have a situation where I have an opinion, I hold it fairly strongly, but I think the statutory language and the legislative history are such a mess that I would respect anybody who had a view very, very different from mine. I think it's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. The interesting analytic question then is, what are the forces that drive people to reach these different conclusions when several different reasonable conclusions are available? And we're beginning to see some traction in the data, and it appears that the president who nominated you, all right, may make some difference in the final outcome.
and that the relationship between the interpretive standard and the actual result in the case may make a difference at the district court level, so far hasn't shown any traction at the Court of Appeals level. Obviously, much more analysis to be done. All of these conclusions, by the way, could change as soon as we finish categorizing the remaining cases. That's part of the wonder of doing empirical work. And we may find additional results or different results when we apply more powerful statistical techniques. Happy to take questions. Jim.
Are you seeing any trends in how cases are resolved? Are they taking longer to settle or shorter to settle?
From other data, we know that the cases are taking much longer to settle. Prior to the Reform Act, average lifespan of a case was 22 months. On average, be 22 months from the time the complaint is filed to the date that the complaint would be settled. We know that there are about 740 companies that have been sued, according to the Stanford database. No more than 200 of those cases will have been resolved by settlements or by ultimate dismissal. That would leave an inventory in excess of 500 cases sitting in the federal courts. Many of those cases are more than 3 years old, 4 years old now, and the average lifespan of these cases is well above 2 years at this point.
How about size of settlements?
Size of settlements, the data are too small, but here's what appears to be happening. The Sendent settlement is $2.8 billion, just from the company on the common shareholder action, several hundred million dollars more on the prides, and the auditors kicking in about $330 million more, just resets the standard for the high end in settlements in this area. It's more than $3 billion, all right, for the settlement of one class action. The plaintiffs, the lead plaintiffs in that case, also claimed that they recovered more than 50% of their losses. And if that's right, that would also be a record in terms of the percentage recovered. The current thinking is that the frequency with which complaints are going to be dismissed will be higher post-95 Act than pre-95 Act. But if a complaint is not dismissed at the motion to dismiss stage or at the summary judgment stage, plaintiffs will argue that the value of their inventory is much higher. All right? We just had a judge say that our complaint is worth more because it survived a higher threshold. So you're going to have to pay me more to get rid of this case. And the data appear to be consistent with that kind of a dynamic, that it appears the percentage of cases being dismissed is starting to go up slightly from the pre-95 Act benchmark of 20%, and we are seeing bigger settlements in many of the cases that do settle. Yes?
Is there a trend in the number of cases filed? Like last year, I think you said that there really hadn't been that much of an impact on the actual number of cases filed since 1995.
That's right. In 1998, there was a record number of companies sued for class action securities fraud. In 99, the numbers are down by about 10%. But the big news in 99 was the size of the settlements. Numbers that were considered inconceivable 2 or 3 years ago are now actually out there in the record, and you know, plaintiffs are going to be pushing for much higher settlements in cases that aren't thrown out.
But is that not a function of the market cap?
Is that not a function of the market cap? Of the market cap of the individual?
Market caps are record levels too.
Yeah,
so
but that's
the losses that you're taking in on the stocks are significantly higher than they were based on market caps 5 years ago.
The observation being market caps are higher now, therefore any given percentage decline in the value of a company's stock puts more money at risk. Therefore, you would expect larger settlements if the size of the decline is rationally related to the settlement. There is a theory that says the size of the decline is not that closely related, at least in pre-95 Act cases, to the size of the settlement. Instead, what's important once you get past the motion to dismiss or summary judgment is the size of the insurance policy and the net worth of the parties who may actually be named in the complaint. And it turns out there are predictive models that work very well on that theory rather than looking at the actual size of the stock decline. The other thing that's interesting is in Sendent, it's not just that 2.8 billion number. It's the claim by the lead plaintiffs that they've recovered 50% of their losses. Prior to the Reform Act, 15% or 10% was more likely an accurate description of the percentage of losses recovered in settlement. So if the percentage is raised to 50%, all right, then an increase in the size of settlements will be driven by factors much larger than the increase in market cap. It'll be the combination of the market cap plus a larger percentage of that larger market cap having to be paid out. So I think defendants and insurers are looking at a potentially dangerous new landscape in this space. Another question? Yes, all the way in back.
Yeah, another interesting trend that I think we've seen is it used to be that you got your first lawsuit the day after a stock drop, and then after the 95 Act, it went to weeks or even months after, and now we're back to the old days where you get the first suit right after the stock drop. Any thoughts on why that's happened?
Yeah, because plaintiffs at the beginning weren't really sure how to operate under the new Reform Act. They've gotten much more comfortable with the procedures. They understand better how to write those complaints. And also, there are many more cases now where, because of restatements or other reasons, the announcement of the facts leading to the stock price decline basically give the plaintiffs everything they need in order to attempt to plead a strong inference. Simply have a look at the events in Cendant. All right, look at the press releases that came out in Cendant. The company, in effect, pled guilty. All right, under the Civil Act, it gave you all the elements of the cause of action in its own press release. There really wasn't very much work left to do other than to slap a caption on the press release and file it with the court. Okay? You had to find a plaintiff. Okay. But that's really all that it took. And as a practical matter, given the disclosures that Cendant has made, that Waste Management has made, that McKesson has made, I would be surprised if more than a day would have passed before the plaintiffs would have filed. So, and the other thing that's happening is plaintiffs are still taking more time, but those are typically in the smaller cases and in the more ambiguous cases, which is pretty much what you would expect.
Are we seeing any sort of trend on the type of facts that are giving rise to a claim? I mean, is there a shift away from forward-looking statements and more toward claims based on accounting?
Yeah, the two big theories that plaintiffs are pleading in order to support their complaints are some accounting misstatement, and more than 50% of the last sample that we looked at, which is now an old sample, but we actually think the numbers are still robust. More than 50% of the complaints allege some form of accounting misstatement, and more than 50% of the complaints allege trading by insiders during the period when the fraud was alive. And that goes to more than 100% because many complaints allege both, that during the period that the accounting fraud was alive, the insiders were selling their shares into the market. The number of cases not alleging either is now well under 10%. I think plaintiffs are figuring out that if you can't allege an accounting fraud or insider sales, it's going to get harder to get past that motive and opportunity standard or the strong inference standard. Those cases still exist, but they're less frequent than they were before.
How about forward-looking statements?
Forward-looking statements, we have found that the allegations are typically thrown, to the extent that they arise, they're typically thrown in with accounting allegations and insider trading allegations, so they're an add-on, and it's very rare to find that it's just a forward-looking statement case. Yes,
sir. Why do you think there's more restatements today than there were 10 years ago?
Well, there's several different theories for that. You know, number one is there are more transactions where the accounting treatment is ambiguous. Reasonable people can differ. The SEC then says we'd like a different interpretation. People have to scramble and they have to restate. Another theory for it would be to say that mistakes are being made with higher frequency, and then when the mistakes are caught, you're really forced to restate. I don't know enough. I haven't looked at the data carefully enough in that area to actually have an opinion. But there is something that's sort of, you know, a screaming casual observation, and that is in many of the largest fraud cases, they're related to transactions involving mergers or a string of mergers. Look at the Cendant case. Cendant acquired a company where there was fraud at the company being acquired. Look at the McKesson case. McKesson acquired a company where there was fraud at the company being acquired. Look at Waste Management. It was, in effect, a roll-up company, and now we're learning that there was fraud at many of the companies that were being acquired. If you look at the list of companies that are sued, I think you'll find a disproportionate number of those companies having engaged in merger activity, and there being some fraud either at the company acquiring, but probably more frequently at the company being acquired, suggesting that these companies that are selling out or being acquired, managements might know that they're playing an end game and they'd like to be able to get rid of the company before the fraud is discovered, in effect sell out, all right, in toto, get the proceeds, and then if the fraud is discovered, it's after they're off the scene. That is a pattern of behavior that's hard to argue with. Other questions? It's late, ladies and gentlemen. You've been a terrific audience. This amount of patience for detailed data about how judges operate is beyond the pale, and I'd like to thank you all for being such a terrific audience. Thank you very much.